Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. We come to the next talk in this collection, the Ajahn Sumedho Anthology, Volume 3, called Direct Realization. And these talks are from the book The Way It Is, which is mostly comprised of Dhamma talks that Lumpur Sumedho gave in the winter retreat of 1988 here at Amravati. This is Chapter 12, called Consciousness and Sensitivity. Sometimes we approach meditation from a way of thinking that is based on trying to get rid of unwanted mental states and to control the mind. It's better to see meditation as an opportunity to be mindful, to be at peace with yourself and with whatever mood you happen to be in at this moment, rather than trying to achieve some kind of desired state. Learn to be one who is at peace with the way things are. When I started meditation in Thailand, the way I had lived my life before I became a monk affected my meditation practice. I began to let go of things and to accept all my ambitious and aggressive tendencies and to be attentive to the way things are. The more you trust in this, the more quickly you will understand it's the way out of suffering. Notice how things affect your mind. If you're starting a meditation period having just come from your work, notice what that does to your mind. If the mind isn't tranquil and pure and serene, don't criticize it. Notice the busyness of it all. You've been traveling in the rush hour, working at the keyboard, talking on the telephone, and maybe having to work with people that you don't like, in difficult, aggravating situations. Just notice all of it. These things do have an effect on us. This is the experience of consciousness and sensitivity. And particularly example or the description that Lumpur is giving here, I remember him talking about a particular conversation he had when they lived in Hampstead back in the late 70s, 77, 78, when they were living at the Hampstead Vihara. And one of the regular visitors to the monastery was a very dedicated meditator, and she was concerned that whenever she sat down to meditate in the evening in her home, that her mind was you know, really, really busy and agitated. And Lumpur talked with her and asked about, you know, her experience of meditation, what kind of method she was using, and so on and so forth, and trying to give her some guidance. Then he asked her, what kind of work do you do? And she said she was a telephone operator. So in those days, back in the 1970s, there used to be what's called a telephone exchange, and a person who was what's called a telephonist would sit by the kind of what's called the switchboard and have wires that would be plugged in to join one phone call up with a caller with a recipient. And so you're in this crowded environment with lots of bells going and people speaking to you through the headphones, and you've got to carry out detailed work. So it's a noisy, active, you know, and pressurized environment, and famously so, this sort of being on a telephone exchange. And so he said, well, after you've been doing that for 8 hours, then that's going to have its effect, there's no way that you're going to be in that kind of environment with that sort of input of noise and activity and voices and engagement, and then suddenly switch it off and the mind's going to be able to focus straight away on the breath and put everything else aside. And so he often spoke about that as a good example of exactly this principle of being ready to make peace with the things that the mind has been affected by, and so that as Lumpu Cha would put it, peace comes from right understanding, from right attitude, rather than not having any kind of disturbances. And so that's a very helpful principle. Right now, Amravati is a very quiet environment. Not only the winter retreat, but also the pandemic. So we have almost no visitors onto the site at all, and certainly not the active busyness that often comes, on a weekend in the usual times here at Amravati. But still, we can notice the things that affect our mind. If you've had a difficult conversation with someone, that's been, a tension between you has been demonstrated, someone has got upset with you and has criticized you, or that they are filled with some kind of an opinion that they have, that they're all charged up and excited about, and you've just come from that conversation. If you come into the meditation hall, then there's going to be a resonance, there's going to be the reverberation of someone's, the excited conversation, or the criticism, or the anxiety, whatever it might be. That's very likely to have its impact. And as Lumpur Sumedho put it here, when he first started practicing in Thailand, I began to let go of things and to accept all my ambitious and aggressive tendencies. So that he recognized that growing up in America, being in his early 30s, he had a lot of conditioning around the life of a white, educated, middle-class male in America, growing up in the 40s and 50s, and the effect of being in a university environment. He'd been at the University of California in Berkeley, and then before that in the U.S. Navy. So he had a lot of conditioning around that kind of society, how you function as a person in that society. And as you said, your ambitious and aggressive tendencies that would be encouraged and expected of you. And so that the coming into monastic life or coming into meditation practice, then it's wise to recognize this is the conditioning that's here. That's what this system has been affected by. So that's going to carry on. That's going to have its momentum. So it's important to respect that and not just say, well, I shouldn't be thinking this way, I shouldn't be feeling this way, I shouldn't have these things having this particular kind of effect on my mind. So as he says, this is the experience of consciousness and sensitivity. It is what being born as a human being amounts to. You're born. You have to live a lifetime as a conscious being in a very sensitive form. And what impinges on you, what comes to you from the objective world, is going to affect you. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the way it is. The problem is that we tend to make everything very personal. We feel like it's wrong. I shouldn't be affected by these things that impinge on me. I shouldn't feel anger or aversion or greed or irritation and frustration, envy, jealousy, fear, anxiety. I shouldn't be feeling these things. If I were a normal, healthy person, I wouldn't have any of these problems. I wouldn't be sensitive at all, like a rhinoceros with a tough hide that nothing could ever get through. So maybe I'm not normal. That said, I'm sure rhinoceroses have their own kinds of sensitivity, particularly in relationship to other rhinoceroses. Anyway, I think you get the point, the thick-skinned creature. So maybe I'm not normal, but it's just the way it is. Life is like this. Because we are human, we have these extremely sensitive forms, and there's nothing really wrong with that. There are many irritating things about aspects of our lives, but being sensitive is like that, isn't it? Sensitivity means that whatever it is, pleasant or unpleasant, pleasurable, painful, beautiful, ugly, we are going to feel it. So the way out of suffering is through mindfulness and not self. There is only the awareness of our true nature, blissful and serene and pure. If we find this peace and serenity depends on conditions being a certain way, and we need to control these conditions in order to abide in the blissful serenity of the purity of the mind, then it's all coming from desire, wrong view. Mindfulness and understanding allows you to adapt and accept life, the total life experience, without having to control it. You don't have to hold on to the bits and pieces you like, and feel threatened by the possibility of being separated from them. Right meditation really allows you to be brave and adaptable, to be flexible, and all that implies. There's a few very significant items there. That sense of a feeling I shouldn't be affected by these things, and when the mind is excited by something, or distracted, or worried about something, or irritated by something, then this kind of wise reflection to explore, well, you know, why is this coming to mind, or why is this so worrying, or exciting, or irritating, where does this come from? And that kind of appreciation of the conditioning that we have, what we've been through in our lives, or the conversation we had earlier in the day, or what is going on in the world around us, then to take that in and to recognize, oh, it's cold and windy, so therefore I'm getting blasted around. It's a windy day. That's what the weather's doing. So I'm having this experience of being buffeted, or it's very chilly. The temperature has dropped, and so I'm shivering. That's because of the cold weather. And so on and so forth. So even though those states might be uncomfortable, feeling worried or feeling excited or feeling irritated, feeling sad or alienated, feeling lonely or feeling that you're a failure and so on, just the sort of drawing back from the details of that experience and to reflect on the felt sense of it, feeling alienated or feeling lonely or feeling excited or feeling worried or whatever it might be, just to look at and feel the broader picture and to consider what the conditioning factors are, where's this coming from, or what's the effect of that. And then one of the aspects of the practice is seeing how cause and effect work. And if you've people have noticed how when we do the reflection on the four Brahmaviharas, the may I abide in well-being and so forth, the fourth one, the reflection on the development of equanimity, upekha, the wording of that, the encouraged reflection is, I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma, whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So the source of equanimity is an appreciation of cause and effect. So this kind of reflection I see that Lumpur is talking about is very much like you're recognizing the cause and effect. Because of this, there is that. Oh, nothing's out of order here. Nothing's gone wrong. This is just because of A, therefore B. This is the cause, this is the effect. This is a natural process. So it helps the mind to let go of the self-centered perspective and also to see things in terms of nature, seeing that it's not a personal issue, it's just how nature is operating. Similarly, when you look at the development of the four foundations of mindfulness, we were talking about this a few days ago. In the third foundation of mindfulness, the Cittanupassana, then one of the things that that is significant to me in that the description that you have in the sutta is there's no kind of value judgment around the different mental states. It's just knowing the angry mind is angry, knowing the mind free of anger is free of anger, knowing the lustful mind is filled with lust, the mind free of lust is free of lust, knowing the agitated mind is agitated, the unagitated mind is unagitated, the concentrated mind is concentrated, the unconcentrated mind is unconcentrated, and so on. I think there's about 16 pairs of qualities. Anyway, the lack of value judgment is just saying, in this moment there is this. This is, the angry mind feels like this, or when the mind is free of anger it feels like this. So that it's bringing attention to, oh, this is something that the mind can feel. Like Lumpur's saying, this, the mind is conscious, it's awake, and it's sensitive. So it can feel agitation or freedom from agitation. It can feel the experience of being expanded or contracted. And those are simply, as it says in the Satipatthana Sutta, the foundations of mindfulness, just knowing simply, you know, there is this. That's the establishment of mindfulness in relationship to that particular quality. And I feel it's quite significant in that there isn't any value judgment. There's no mention of wholesome or unwholesome or beneficial or unbeneficial. It's just, this is the way it is. It's like this. So it's that open-hearted appreciation of what is present. So in the second part of this, then Lumpur goes on to say, so the way out of suffering is through mindfulness and not self. There's only the awareness of our true nature, blissful and serene and pure. So this is a way that Lumpur Cha and a number of the forest Ajahns would talk about the mind awakening to Dhamma, and so that in the book Bodhinyana, one of the very first collection of Lumpur Cha's teachings that were published in English, when he defines Buddha Dhamma, then he defines Buddha as being the quality of awareness and wakefulness. And Dhamma is the qualities of purity, radiance, and peacefulness that are experienced when the mind is awake to the way things are. So that when Lumpur uses that language, awareness of our true nature, that's saying that the mind aware, mind awakened to its own nature as Dhamma, and then those qualities of radiance, purity, and peacefulness that are often used as a kind of synopsis of the experience of the mind awake to its own nature, awake to Dhamma. And in Thai, they have a very neat alliteration of those qualities. Sawang means radiant, Sa'at means pure, and Sangop means peaceful. So radiant, pure, and peaceful. So that's a common phrase that's used in the forest tradition, Sawang, Sa'at, Sangop. And Lumpur Cha would use that quite often, and I think also Lumpur Buddhadasa similarly would use that as a way of, say, summarizing the mind's experience of Dhamma. So, but then Lumpur uses that then, saying if that's that's the case, that realization is there. But then, if that realization then is dependent on our particular situation, like having no noise around your kuti, or having no duties to attend to, or not having had any difficult conversations in the last 3 days, or whatever it might be, or not having any illnesses or aching knees or whatever, then the mind can easily get dependent on those particular conditions. And so, as he says, if we find this peace and serenity depends on conditions being a certain way, and we need to control those conditions in order to abide in the blissful serenity of the purity of the mind, then it's all coming from desire, wrong view. So that the mind goes to, rather than the purity of that, the mind awake to its own nature, it gets fixated on the ideal conditions that are wished for in order for that realization to be sustained or to be realized. And so then that sense of controlling, getting busy with, I want this, I don't want that, it should be this way, it shouldn't be that way, then purity of awareness has been lost in the mind getting busy with trying to control and get this and get rid of that, which then Lumpur points out is based on wrong view. As he says, you don't have to hold on to the bits and pieces you like and feel threatened by the possibility of being separated from them. Right meditation, so right as in attuned or samma, meditation that's in tune with reality, right meditation really allows you to be brave and adaptable, to be flexible, and all that implies, so that the presence of supportive conditions can be helpful, but the mind doesn't fixate upon that. Rather, the mind is resting in that quality of of awareness and an openness of attitude in each moment. So, and as Lumpu Cha would say, you're right, peace doesn't come from being with the people that you like or being separated from people. It doesn't come from being with your friends or being alone. Peace comes from right understanding. So that is it's always the case, even though we set up a meditation retreat to have silence and solitude, and we deliberately put supportive conditions in place. You know, we have a retreat, we call it a retreat. We do craft those sapaya, those supportive conditions, quite deliberately. But the trick then, or the kind of part of the effort then, is not to be dependent on those supportive conditions, or feel like if it isn't a retreat time, then I can't practice, or I want the retreat time to come, or want my solo retreat time to come, then I can really practice. And that Lumpu Cha, Lumpu Sumato, have spent a lot of time over the years encouraging an understanding that it's the moment by moment, say, application of the practice, regardless of conditions. That's what is really going to liberate the heart. That is not not to be dependent on a particular set of conditions. Because as soon as we create that kind of dependency, then in that, then the causes for agitation and dukkha are being created right there. That partiality, that sense of I want this, I don't want that, it's got to be this way, I can't have it that way, right there, the causes for dukkha have been created. Any questions, thoughts, reflections on any of that? Gaspar, please come and take the mic.
Thank you, Ajahn. If I may just to backtrack a little bit, a few days ago, I think we managed to, you so skillfully synthesized sort of the teachings of the Buddha into four words: don't cling to anything. And so in order to not cling to anything, one must virtually let go. But in contemplating this thought of letting go, I sort of find sort of like a circular quality to it, because you can always let go of letting go. So sort of in order to free the mind, liberate the heart, one must let go. But then in that letting go, there is the letting go of trying to liberate the mind and the heart. And in conjunction with this, perhaps a silly question, but is there, in letting go of this sort of striving for liberation, is there any merit to staying ignorant in life, but doing it in a way that is propelled by a sense of compassion for others, in a sense that's saying, okay, you know, I know what is the true path, but I also see struggling of other people in the world, and perhaps there is sort of like a sense of, an obligation to maybe stay and help in different ways, as opposed to just, turning inside and then trying to liberate yourself. I don't know, something, I'm not sure if this is a question, but these are my thoughts, and if you can comment, I'll appreciate it. Thank you.
There's a few things there. We talk about letting go, but ideally, there's no clinging in the first place. So that instruction, sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesaya, it's not just about letting go, it's also about not clinging. Yeah, so that the and Lumpu Cha would point out that the practice is learning how to hold and then let go. So you can pick something up, hold it, and then put it down. So it's the clinging is the thing that produces the agitation. But a lot of life is to do with skillfully picking things up, using them, and then when the time is present to finish using them, you put them down. So that any skillful use of conventions, like having a Dhamma reading or asking a question or practicing meditation, being a Buddhist monastic, spending time in the monastery, those are forms that are picked up and used for a period of time for a particular purpose. So that learning how to use a social form, to use an aspect of speech or action, those are learning how to hold without grasping, without clinging. And so that distinction between holding and clinging is something that you have to learn through experimentation and practice. And just like learning a language or learning a skill, like how to run a video program, you know, you try it out and you use it over and over and over, and slowly a skill develops. So discerning when the mind is genuinely, you know, holding and using, and is without attachment, without grasping, and when there is grasping present, you get to know that. You get the feeling for it. Like if you're trained in music, you train your ear so that you can tell when things are on pitch or off pitch, and then you also there's an intuitive sense of how to adjust, how to adapt. In terms of letting go, again, Lumpur Cha in Lumpur Sumedha would often talk about this, how it can be seen to be a conundrum that you're supposed to be letting go of desire, but there's a desire for enlightenment. And it goes right back to the Buddha, and in his time that same question came up. And there's a particular dialogue that illustrates it very clearly. It was between Venerable Ananda and a layman called Unaba, and they were in Kosambi. And Unaba asked Venerable Ananda, so what is the summary of the Buddha's teaching? And then Venerable Ananda says, the summary of the Buddha's teaching is to let go of all desire. And then Unaba says, but that's a circular argument. This is interminable. It's not terminable. It's circular, because how can you desire to let go of desire? And then Venerable Ananda gives this this very good description, and he points out, essentially, there's two kinds of desire. One is tanha, which is maybe better translated as craving, and has always got a self-centered element to it. The other kind of desire is chanda. And so then Venerable Ananda asks Unaba, so did you have the desire to come to Gosita's monastery? And he said, yes, I had that desire. So, and then when you had that desire, were you able to act on it? He said, yes, I was. So when you acted on it, then did you realize when you were approaching the Gosita Rama, did you think about the pathway you should take to get here, and keep in mind what your goal was? He says, yes, I was thinking about it. I followed that particular path. I thought which roads I needed to follow. And then Ananda said, so then finally, when you reached the Gosita Rama, did you know I have reached the Gosita Rama? He says, yes, right, I did. And so in that, he's laying out what are called the four bases of success, the Iddhipada. So chanda, virya, citta, and vimamsa. Chanda is interest. Were you interested to come to the Gosita Rama? Yes. Virya, did you expend energy to get up and go? Yes. Citta, did you think about how to get here? Yes, I did. And then vimamsa, having arrived here, did you realize I've arrived? Yes. And so then I said, then when you'd arrived here, what happened to the desire for you to get here? He said, well, it went away because I've arrived. And I said, yeah, exactly. So this is the way that desire, if it's chanda, then once it's achieved its result, then there's no remainder. And so that then Unaba was very impressed by that argument and said, yeah, this is terminable. It's not interminable. I can see the sense of this. And so that's essentially learning how to use chanda rather than tanha. Again, it's a telling the difference between holding and grasping or clinging, because chanda is that motivating principle. You can also translate it as interest, enthusiasm, zeal. It's the sort of the directionality or the fire of the mind, like, yeah, I'm interested. So that chanda can be completely free of delusion, can be completely free of self-view and any kind of obstructive or destructive qualities. So that's, again, a large part of our practice is to train the heart to recognize the difference between chanda and tanha. These, in English, you can use the word desire equally applicably for both of those, but they have a very different flavor. The chanda, it just means interest or enthusiasm. So it can refer to things that are unwholesome or worldly, like karma chanda, like sense desire. So it can refer to that. But in this respect, it would be dhamma chanda, like the desire for dhamma. And so that recognition of where self-view and greed, hatred, delusion and so on sort of slide into the picture and affect chanda, that's part of what's an essential element of the practice. So then you can use desire to come to the end of desire. And so it's very, very rarely is the word tanha used in that sense. I know of like one or two places in the Pali canon where the Buddha just uses the word tanha for that, but the vast majority of times then the word chanda is used to refer to that kind of skillful directionality where the mind is given a direction and a kind of motivating quality is there. So that's with respect to your first one. And then the second question about, is it a good idea to remain ignorant for the benefit of other beings? You can probably guess my response to this is that there might be a well-intentioned, but my experience shows that the less that the mind is affected by greed, hatred, and delusion, the better it is for everyone around you. You might feel, it's rather like, oh, my mates want to go out and get drunk. I should show that I'm not judging them. I should just be one of the lads because the boys are going out for a night of drinking. I don't want to be kind of spoiling the party. I don't want to be judging them, or I don't want to break up the group, so I should go along and get drunk with the lads. Well, yeah, you can do that. But what will happen during that drunken night and what the results of that might be? So it might be well-intentioned, wanting to express friendliness and supportiveness and not to be judgmental. But if you take a step back from that and look at the picture in a bit more of a broad way, maybe you, as a trusted and respected member of the group, saying, just don't feel interested, sorry, I hope you have a good night, but I've got other things to be doing. And if that's coming from a non-judgmental place in you, even though they might think, who does Gaspar think he is? Oh, he's the holy man now. Grumble, grumble, grumble. I'm just making this up, but that has, when I was a layman more than 40 years ago, this kind of thing did happen. But then if you're coming from a sincere place, and someone just says, no, I'm just not interested, then even though on a surface level you might say, why doesn't she or he just join in with it like the rest of us, something goes in the heart goes, yeah, right, that's a good point. why shouldn't they go their own way? Or why should they want to do this just because the rest of us like it? Why shouldn't somebody be different? And if it's coming from a sincere place, it's coming from a place of kindness and a place of empathy, then it can set a good example. If you think, I'm going to set them a good example, I'll show them, then there's a bit of atta, self-view and judgmentalism there. But I would suggest that just taking a step back and assessing the situation and then just searching the heart for what's really going to be a benefit. And then that, say, inclination towards wisdom and truth and virtue can be something as a beneficial presence in the lives of others. So in that respect, I would say the less ignorance, the better. My opinion on the matter. Any other questions, comments? Anagarika Evgenia?
May I ask, in regard to this last question, could it be said that a sign of how to distinguish between this chanda and tanha when you do something? In my experience, I see that if I have a right answer or right solution, usually...
Do you have a what?
Right answer or right mm-hmm. solution or right understanding of situation, what to do or how to act. Usually it's not so much of kind of thinking or arguing or logic to it, not intellectual, it's just kind of more silent. And if there is this whistling kind of atta mind that wants to present it as something good, but actually usually it's a lot of logic, like very... Yeah.
The inner legal team gets brought in.
Yes, yes. And sometimes you kind of, when you acknowledge the right answer, you don't really want to agree with it, but deep down you know that it's yes, and it's kind of unarguable, but just before you didn't want to... And it seems that all this kind of chattering and talking, it's more about trying to argue with what you yes. know already. And when you go in the right direction, you just, yes, okay, I agree, I go along. But the heart knows, so when it's something right, when it's really kind of chanda, when it's a right step, usually there is a kind of more quietness, not so much of... doubting or choice, it's just, okay.
Yeah, I think I think that that's very true. I think it's a good way of describing it, that there's a simplicity when there's an intuitive sense of, yeah, this is a good way forward. And that when things are being guided by tanha and self-view, there's the sort of the inner legal team, sort of justification. Yeah, self-justification, coming up with good reasons why this is great. if there's an intuitive sense of yeah, this is a good way forward, or this looks like a helpful path to follow. There's a natural, not I mean won't always be the case, but generally I would say is a natural simplicity and an uncomplicated quality to that. Okay, so to continue. Things happen. Mother Nature has a way of letting us know that she's not just going to go along with our desires. If we try to control everything and make it so that we're not being affected by any of it, or only affected in the ways that we like, then even if we get a measure of control over things, we just increase the suffering because conditions are changing all the time. We have to live with this body for a lifetime, and bodies are conscious and sensitive forms. This is what being born means: getting old, sickness, and then death. By knowing the way it is, you find you're capable of accepting life, not bewildered by the way that life happens to be. If you understand it and see it in the right way, you're not going to have wrong view. You're not going to add to it with fears, desires, bitterness, resentments, and blame. We have the ability to accept the way life is. Understanding Dhamma allows us also to have a fearless attitude. We begin to realize that we can accept whatever happens. There's really nothing to be afraid of. Then you can let go of life. You can follow it because you're not expecting anything out of it, and you're not trying to control it. You have the wisdom, the mindfulness, the ability to go with the flow rather than be drowned in the tidal wave of life. Oftentimes when people ask me what it's like being the abbot of Amravati, people often ask. Well, at least in the days when people used to come and visit, and I would be meeting a lot more people, they would regularly say, "What do you do? How is it? What's it like trying to be running a place like Amravati?" And one of the things that I say is that I don't try to control it. I said, "If you're a control freak, then at Amravati you will suffer necessarily. That's." In any domain, whether you are the abbot or any particular area you happen to be technically in charge of or responsible for, if you're trying to control everything, then you create a lot of suffering. And that it's not that you don't care, but if you have a fixed idea about exactly how things should be and your plan, then you will suffer. So that's one of the things I almost invariably mention if people ask, how do you take on the role of being the abbot? Says, well, I don't have that tendency to be a control freak, and that and I feel that's one of the things that makes our ability to choose or to guide more effective. That you have a sense of where it looks like it's a good direction, but there's a fundamental adaptability that you see. Okay, well, I'd like it to go this way. This looks like a good direction or a good result. Let's try this and see what happens. And so for some people, it's like, well, you're just being wishy-washy. You should be more decisive. You should just command and set things in the direction that you know is right. But my experience of a number of my respected and beloved brethren who have more of those controlling tendencies is that it creates a lot of stress in the people around them and in themselves as well. And so that it's well-intentioned and there might be some good results that come from it, but trying to make the world continually fit your expected, or desired shape, that you want it to be this way, you don't want it to be that way, that you've got a fixed idea about how it should be and what shape it should take, then endlessly, as Lumpo puts it here, Mother Nature has a way of letting us know that she's not going to go along with our desires. Oh, you're determined to put the building there, are you? Oh, very interesting. And then things come along, things happen. Yeah, and so that along with having a sense what is a skillful direction, if there isn't that fundamental flexibility and readiness to adapt and to change, then we're always colliding with life, and it's a very abrasive. There's a lot of colliding with the world, and a lot of frustration and difficulty, because no matter how hard we try, the world continues to not go the way that we want. That the laws of nature continue to be active, and the way things evolve is always somewhat unpredictable. And so that readiness to have a sense of what looks like a good direction, and then to be ready to adjust and to attune to the different people who are involved, the different changes in the weather or the circumstances, or suddenly the laws are changed and you have to do things differently, then it's mysterious, but that's how you get things to evolve in a skillful way, is by not being rigid about it, as in the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views. Then that is one of the ways that we can work harmoniously. So it's not a matter of not caring or being completely sort of wishy-washy, but it's a readiness to bend and to adapt to circumstances. And as Lumpur puts it, then you can let go of life. So letting go of life doesn't mean that you don't care. It just means having that flexibility. So like in the natural world of, say, the world of trees, if a tree is if the tree is very old and rigid, then if the strong wind blows, then the branch is going to break and drop off, or the whole trunk might break. If the tree is a bit more bendable and flexible when the strong winds blow, then it can move, it can bend in the wind. If it has no strength in it, then it'll just it would just flop over and wouldn't stand up and hold the leaves up in the sunlight. So it needs to have a certain amount of strength and firmness. But if it's too rigid, then it breaks in the wind, and then its life and its viability is not sustained. Take the time to be silent. Listen to yourself. The breathing, just the natural rhythm of the body, the way your body feels now. The body is a condition in nature. It's not really you. It's not my breathing anymore. It's not personal. You breathe even if you're sick. And if you're asleep, you're still breathing. It's the body that breathes. From birth to death, it will be breathing. So that's why we use it as an object to focus on, to turn to if we're thinking too much. When thoughts get convoluted and complicated, we bring attention to the ordinary breathing of the body at this moment, and we aren't lost in thought anymore. We're being attentive to a natural rhythm. But as soon as you start thinking, you can't concentrate on the breath. It becomes a me again, and I am trying to be mindful of my breath. But when you're just with the breath, there's no self. The self will arise when you start thinking. When you're not thinking, there's no self. When you're mindful, thought isn't coming from wrong view, the view that I am a self. It's one of aspects of the breath is that there is a measure of personal control. We can decide to breathe deeply or to breathe in a shallow way. We can hold our breath. We can breathe long or short. So there's a measure of personal control, and so we use language like I am breathing, and that the sense of it being something that I am doing is very easy to sort of come into focus. But as we were mentioning a few readings ago, that the more that there is a sense of me doing the breath, then the more it's sort of it's labored and hard work. It's a chore. And then with the development of the practice, the less sense of self there is there, the less self-view that's involved, then it's more that there's an awareness of the body breathing. The body breathes, as Dongpo puts it here. It's the body that breathes. So things that we don't have any personal control over, like the heartbeat, we don't say, I beat my heart. Anyone? I don't know if maybe in some of your languages they say that, but I don't think any language that I know of says, you know, I beat my heart. It's just that the heart beats. It's not, there's no personal control over it. And so that that illusion of self around that doesn't form. And it's one of the reasons I find that listening to the inner sound, the nada, is a very helpful meditation object, because there's no personal control over that. You can pay attention to it or you can not pay attention to it, but you can't, I can't make it louder. Like, I want it to be louder. No effect. I want it to be quieter. No effect. I want it to be over on my left and not on my right. No, it doesn't respond. So the inner sound is present. You can listen to it if that's something that the mind is capable of discerning. But that very lack, like the heartbeat, the very lack of personal control, that I can't do anything with it, I can pay attention to it or not pay attention to it, that I find is a supportive aspect of using it, developing it as a meditation object, because it doesn't feed that the habit of me the controller, me the one who's doing, but rather there's an alertness and a receptivity is the basis of the meditation. Thought can be a way of reflection, a way of focusing attention on Dhamma rather than of creating problems of self-criticism or anxiety about yourself and humanity. When you get angry and you're thinking, he said that to me, how dare he, that dirty so-and-so, if you stop thinking and just use the breath, eventually, the feeling of the body that comes with the anger will fade away, and then there's no anger. So if you feel angry, just reflect on what it feels like as a physical feeling. It's the same with any mood. Contemplate, Reflect on the mood that you're in. Just work with it. Not to analyze it or criticize it. Just reflect on it, how it is. Some people say, I get very confused when I meditate. How can I get rid of confusion? Wanting to get rid of confusion is the problem. Being confused and not wanting it to be like that just creates more confusion. So, what does it feel like? Confusion may not feel like the more stimulating passions that we can have that are quite obvious. We tend not to pay any attention to the more subtle states like hesitation or doubt or slight anxiety. Of course, one side of us just wants to get rid of all of that, just to stomp it out. But with right understanding, we can see that the very desire to get rid of, quote unquote, is suffering. In fact, we can bear with the feeling of insecurity if we know what it is, and that it's impermanent. With this understanding, you begin to feel more and more confident in just being aware and mindful. All of this is emphasizing the usefulness of wise reflection, that yoniso manasikara or dhammavijaya, that sense of exploring and using that in relationship to emotional states, and using the physical sensation of those two. Say something that's vivid, as he says, the more stimulating passions like anger or lust or excitement or fear, the kind of emotional states that get the attention. But often that quality of wise reflection and using the sensations of the body are very helpful with these more subtle kinds of emotional states, like being confused. You know, the mind might be caught up in a particular idea, or just being sleepy and fuzzy and not quite sure what's going on or what you're feeling, and or, as he says, feeling hesitant or slight anxiety or doubt. You know, we get drawn into the content of the anxiety or that a feeling of hesitancy. Oh, I'm not quite sure. Should I be doing this? Should I not? Which isn't really attention grabbing like anger or fear, but it has an effect. And so that use of wise reflection is, oh, here is the mind feeling confused or particularly, he doesn't mention it here so much, but dullness, often the quality of feeling dull and sleepy, you know, you're trying to get rid of it or to wake up or to not feel dull, but you can use that experience of dullness, the sensations of the body when it's in a sort of a dull and heavy, droopy state in the sitting practice, just to know that as a felt sense, to know that as an experience. And often just taking the name of it, this is dullness. Dullness feels like this, and just that degree of reflection, not very complicated or particularly involved or detailed. Just here it is. This is the feeling of dullness, or this is the mind confused, not knowing which way is up. That's what this is. It feels like this. Just that degree of reflection gives a perspective. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be suddenly energized, but there's a perspective. The mind is not identified or not lost in that state in the same way. And that's an extremely helpful practice. And obviously, if you're dull and sleepy, the readiness to wake up and to be aware or to be investigating, the urge to do that is a bit less because you're sleepy and you're not particularly alert. But still, it's the case that if you're ready to apply that, if you know this is a good way of dealing with dullness or confusion or sleepiness or these other subtle kinds of emotion, or like, you know, regret or sort of a nebulous sadness, a sort of manky, I don't really know what I feel, but it's not very nice, it's not awful, but it's just kind of grey and a bit nondescript. You can be mindful of that kind of grey, nondescript feelings, just a little bit not quite right, or just kind of unsatisfied, kind of lonely, kind of not quite happy-ish. And just naming what that is, naming what that felt sense of that, also feeling it in the body to the degree that those things can be felt. There's a way that the heart is freed from the bounds of that, from the identification with that, and that even though that state is present, then there's a clarity with it, and the mind stops creating any kind of suffering around it. There's not the waiting for it to be over, thinking it shouldn't be this way, that, you know, here's a sort of a dull, manky, lonely feeling. It's like this. And in that moment, the feeling might be there, but the mind isn't creating suffering around it. It takes a bit of skill, that's acknowledged. But if that's something that is developed, just to keep noticing, oh, in this moment it's like this, then it becomes a well-worn track. It becomes a way that we train the mind to relate to its own states. And so there's more of a taking refuge in the quality of awareness, that the knowing of those particular sankharas, those particular mental formations, rather than identifying with, you know, trying to hang on to the ones we like or get rid of or switch off in relationship to the ones that we don't like. Any thoughts, questions, reflections on that? Okay, then the last part here. The mind is sensitive to suggestions and assumptions. This is why we're not trying to develop the practice in order to become an enlightened person. Such an assumption fixes you into the belief that right now you're not enlightened, that you've got a lot of problems, that you've got to change your life, you've got to make yourself different and so on, that you're not good enough the way you are right now, so you have to meditate, and hopefully sometime in the future you'll become something that you'd like to become. Well, if you never see the delusion of that way of thinking, then it just carries on. You'll never really become what you should be, no matter how much effort that you put into your meditation. After years of trying to become enlightened, you'll always feel like a failure. And this is because you've still got the wrong attitude about it all. Well, this was, again, in that era, this was a very common theme of Lumpur's. And he would say, you know, if you take the idea, I am an unenlightened person who's got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future, that's the habitual paradigm, that's the framework that, of thought or understanding the mind easily creates. And a lot of the Dhamma talks we hear or the literature that we read says, yes, well, I am an unenlightened person and I have got to do something now to become enlightened in the future. So what's wrong with that idea? But over and over again, Lumpur would point out that let's say that framework, that paradigm of I am a person, right there. It's like, then he said, look, that's the creation of self-view right there. So rather than the paradigm of I am an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future, instead to change the paradigm to being awake now, or as he would say, the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. The awake mind seeing the way things are in this moment. So rather than thinking, I'm this unenlightened person who's got to do something to become an enlightened person, don't put it in the framework of personhood at all, but rather, here's the mind, the quality of awareness, knowing the way things are, this particular set of sights and sounds and smells and tastes, these particular mental formations that are being known, that here's the Buddha mind, the awake, aware mind, knowing the way things are in this moment. And over and over again, he would repeat this. And it takes a bit of contemplation and exploration to get a sense for that. But I found that extraordinarily helpful, because on the worldly level, you say, well, yeah, I am a person. You know, I am an unenlightened person. But seeing that, yes, on the worldly plane, that is true. But then, what is it that knows the person? What is it that's aware of this mind, this body? And there's the realization that that which knows the person isn't a person. That which is aware of all these personal qualities, the body, the mind, the thoughts, the emotions, the feelings, perceptions arising and passing away. That's the level of reality that Lumpur is pointing to, so that rather than identifying with the body, the personality, and starting there, instead that the starting point is this awake, aware quality of the heart. So it's going from that sort of person-centered view to coming to the Dhamma-centered view, and that another way he would phrase it as a way of contemplating, rather than me and my problems, say, here's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, here's the awake mind seeing the way things are. The way things are might be in the shape of a particular problem, like being angry or being jealous or being sleepy or being lustful or being fearful or anxious. But that paradigm, it's a different framework, it's a different way of seeing the present moment experience. And really taking that to heart, that's such a liberating and a helpful change of view, that's something that, again, I acknowledge it takes a bit of time to get a feeling for that, but it makes a huge difference, so that when the mind says, but I am a person, that's what I am, this, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I am, this is my name, my age, my nationality, this is me. To catch that thought and say, yes, but what is it that knows the body, the personality? That which is aware of age doesn't have an age. That which is aware of femininity or masculinity doesn't have a gender. That which knows the feelings of agitation is not agitated. That which knows anger is not angry. And so that it's really bringing things home to the heart, and to change the view in that way, to shift the view to that Dhamma-centered perspective, and then witnessing, knowing the results of that, seeing things in that way, so that it's getting a perspective on self-view, on that the kind of automatic assumptions that the mind makes, and getting to the very root of that. So I find taking that kind of a statement, saying that which knows the person isn't a person, the mind is not a person, the mind is Dhamma. Just taking those simple phrases to actualize that change of view, that change of perspective. And even though it's just a set of words, that if they're brought into being and the mind reflects in that way, and it can bring about, even if it's just for a moment, a second or two, just that the habits of self-view, self-creation, they're interrupted, they pause for a moment, there's a gap, a hesitation, and then the mind sees things in a different way, and then that gives more vitality, more strength to that Dhamma-centered perspective. Any final thoughts, questions, comments? Okay, I'll leave it there. That's the end of that talk. The next one is The Sound of Silence.